Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 18th, 2018. And we begin our daily news and comment podcast here on the Left Coast, where Edmund G. Brown Jr., we know him as Jerry. He used to be called Governor Moonbeam, and Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury deserves credit for that tag. But Jerry Brown is about to vacate the governor's office after historic four terms, interrupted by, what, about 25 years? And he has a very significant legacy. And it's a complicated one. I've been following Jerry Brown since back in the mid-1970s when he hoarded helicopters to spray pesticides over my home in Palo Alto to battle the Mediterranean fruit fly. And he's been controversial. His Supreme Court justices here in California were recalled, with Rose Byrd, the chief, leading the way, because they were seen as too lenient on the death penalty. And when Jerry Brown entered his second round as governor in 2010, he was a more conservative guy. He'd been changed by 8 years as mayor of Oakland and service as the state's attorney general. And so as Jerry Brown departs, I have a lot of fondness for the man. I've enjoyed debating him, and oh, he can be tough. He and Steve Allen are the only two people of the thousands that I've interviewed on live radio who came to the studio with a book, and during the lengthy commercial breaks ignored the host, didn't want to make any small talk, and read their book, and then they were just as amiable as you can imagine when the light went on and the mics went on and we continued the conversation. So I've jousted with Jerry Brown on many issues over the years. And by and large, I think he's been a hell of a good governor for California. But that doesn't stop me from offering honest criticism of the man and his work as governor. And I want to join former governors Dick Celeste of Ohio, John Kitzhaber of Oregon, Martin O'Malley of Maryland, Bill Richardson of New Mexico, Pat Quinn of Illinois, and Tony Anaya, also a former governor of New Mexico. They penned an op-ed pleading with Jerry Brown to clear California's death row, where 740 men languish with no executions imminent. Many of them will die of disease, old age, or suicide, or maybe inmate-on-inmate violence, rather than actually be executed by the state. Now, I have a personal interest in this because I have a friend, James P. Anderson, who languishes on death row to this day. He's been there almost 40 years, behind a crime that he has credibly claimed his innocence of. And I would love to see Jerry Brown accept the advice of these governors and grant clemency, convert their terms from death to life without parole. Now, these governors apparently didn't do enough research, because they say that Brown has the power to commute the sentences of 740 men to save 740 lives. But one of those ballot measures that was named after a crime victim, I don't know if it was Marcy's Law or which one, but it amended the state constitution. And the governor no longer has the unilateral power to commute sentences of people on death row. He needs approval from the state Supreme Court. And so while I would love to see this as a part of the governor's legacy, I don't expect it as a last-minute move from Governor Moonbeam. And meanwhile, a stunning expose, an extraordinary investigative journalism piece, was published on December 17th, yesterday, by the Public Accountability Initiative. Now, I've been seeing their posts on Facebook. They operate under the name Little Sis. And they do a great job exposing corporate ties and corporate conflicts with political people and the interests of the general public. And this lengthy report, it runs 36 pages with all the footnotes, is entitled The California Oil Veto, the Lobbyist Behind Governor Jerry Brown's Concessions to Big Oil. And if you're a regular listener, you may recall in August of last year, I released a podcast with environmental scientist Greg Karas. And he pulled the curtain back on Jerry Brown's celebrated climate change extension, the cap-and-trade bill that had been first signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, and Brown had Arnold there at Treasure Island for the big staged photo op as he signed the bills. And he takes credit for being the crusading climate change activist. But Jerry Brown sat on his hands when the biggest methane leak in California history occurred on his watch at Aliso Canyon. And in the grandstanding that he did with the climate change and the cap-and-trade extension, it included preemption of existing regulations through the state's air quality regional boards. And this report helps us understand why. And it's because of his longtime relationship, this is not sexual, with a woman named Lucy Gikovich. Gikovich was Jerry Brown's staff secretary when he was governor back in the 1970s. She went on to become a lobbyist with Platinum Advisors. And that name may ring a bell to those of you who recently listened to my audio or video report with journalist Peter Byrne, who exposed how Platinum Advisors leader Darius Anderson teamed up with Senator Barbara Boxer's son, Doug, and they fleeced the Grayton Indian tribe as the tribe tried to reassemble, build a rancheria, and ultimately built a casino here in Northern California. That's Platinum Advisors. So Gikovich went on to join a pretty small lobbying firm in Washington, which is called Crane, and she represents some of the big polluters, the extractors, oil and gas clients who do business here in California. One of her lead clients is Phillips 66, and she intervened with Jerry Brown and got him to include allowances worth billions of dollars for the refiners like Phillips. She also lobbies for SoCalGas around that Aliso Canyon disaster, and Brown vetoed a bill that would have granted more litigation rights to victims of this huge methane leak. The report writes, and I quote, Gikovich's lobbying appears to have a powerful effect on the governor. In three separate cases identified in this report, her lobbying efforts around specific pieces of legislation culminated in controversial Brown vetoes favorable to her corporate clients. One bill vetoed by Brown and lobbied against Gikovich would have stopped a proposed dump near tribal land outside San Diego. Another would have allowed for more democratic influence over land use decisions in Southern California, and the other was the Aliso Canyon bill that I mentioned. Now, Gikovich is based in Washington, and when Jerry Brown visits the nation's capital, he stays at her house. Now, he is a flinty guy, and he's saving California money when he does that. But it makes people like us uncomfortable when you see the close proximity that Gikovich enjoys and the influence that she wields and the results that she gets for her clients. So I've linked to this report, and I particularly urge my California listeners to check it out. It was published by a group that's based in Buffalo, New York. I don't think they have any local axe to grind. And I have invited one of the authors of the report, Kevin O'Connor, to join me on a podcast in early January. I hope that'll pan out. Now to Michael Flynn's sentencing hearing today. A bit of a surprise as he went into federal district court in Washington and Judge Emmett Sullivan gave him a lecture. He shamed him. He reamed him. He said the crimes are a very serious offense, that he could not hide his disgust at what Flynn had done. And I think in reference to the Turkey lobbying, not the Russian ambassador phone call he lied about, the judge told Flynn, all along you were an unregistered agent of a foreign country while serving as the national security advisor. That was only 24 days, Your Honor. Arguably, that undermines everything that this flag over here stands for. Arguably, you sold your country out. He even asked attorneys whether the word treason is appropriate. But in a surprise, Judge Sullivan gave Flynn the option of delaying the sentencing until he had completed his cooperation with federal prosecutors. I cannot assure you if you proceed today, you will not receive a sentence of incarceration. Well, Flynn and his lawyer took the hint, and they said, okay, well, we'll delay. I'm not in a hurry on this. And, of course, what is so odd is that two of Flynn's accomplices in the Turkey lobbying deal have been indicted, but Mike Flynn hasn't. Now, usually you give a pass to the little fish so they'll testify against the big fish. But in this case, we don't really know, but it appears that it's the other way around. And this had to surprise the Donald. He tweeted out early this morning, encouragement, good luck today in court to General Mike Flynn. Will be interesting to see what he has to say, despite tremendous pressure being put on him about Russian collusion in our great and obviously highly successful political campaign. There was no collusion. Oh, yeah. I actually don't think we've seen any proof of collusion, but I'm tired of Trump pumping out that talking point. So, Sullivan, the judge, made abundantly clear throughout the proceedings that he viewed the crimes admitted by Flynn as extraordinarily serious. At one point, as I mentioned, he asked prosecutors if Flynn might have committed treason, and the prosecutor said, no, Your Honor, I don't think so. So, we wait and see how the Turkey case goes. But as you know, I think that is much more significant than the phone call with the Russian ambassador that Flynn lied about to the FBI agents. And I do think that there still is that plausible scenario of entrapment of Mike Flynn. New York State's Attorney General Barbara Underwood has ordered the Trump Foundation to be shut down, and all its remaining funds will be given away under judicial supervision. She accused the foundation of a shocking pattern of illegality that was willful and repeated, and included unlawfully coordinating with Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. That relates to his promise to donate $1 million to veterans groups when he skipped one of the debates in Iowa. And they cite Corey Lewandowski, who was the campaign manager, calling the foundation people and saying, hey, come on, get that money out here. That is the connection between the campaign and the foundation that was found to be illegal. So now the Trump side of this story is that they've been trying to dissolve it, but the state of New York dragged its feet. That may or may not be true, but this is clearly a festering, corrupt enterprise, and it should be shut down. Now, the Attorney General is also seeking $2.8 million in restitution and a ban on service on any foundation or charitable boards by any of the Trumpers, Donald, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, who were on the board of the foundation. Trump White House is also signaling that they don't want to shut down the government this Friday at midnight, but this could be just a feint. We probably won't know until Friday, or unless a continuing resolution is passed that punts this into the new year and the new Congress. But, of course, Trump can get almost anything through the House right now until the Democrats take over after the new year. And, of course, the sticking point is funding for the wall, and they're trying to come up with ways to give Trump money that he can claim is for the wall, but the Democrats can say, no way, we're not funding that wall. No, no, we didn't agree to any of that. And it'll come out in the wash somewhere in the middle, and it'll be stinky. You can count on that. Now, today, the Trump administration issued a final rule that bans the so-called bump stock. These are devices that when you attach them to a semi-automatic weapon, they turn into machine guns. And this is what was used at the massacre in Las Vegas a year ago in October. And it took them a while to get this through the system. But, it's a nice step forward. But I can see the bumper sticker already coming from the bankrupt NRA. When bump stocks are outlawed, only outlaws will have bump stocks. States, including California and 15 others, have filed a brief with the judge in Texas, Reed O'Connor, in Fort Worth, the guy who surprised everybody Friday night with the expansive ruling declaring that every element of Obamacare is unconstitutional because the personal mandate was dialed back to the point of meaninglessness by the Trump tax cuts last year. And honestly, this is something I didn't see coming. I didn't think the personal mandate was such a thread that could be pulled and unravel the whole quilt of Obamacare. And the Affordable Care Act, of course, includes so much more than just the personal mandate and pre-existing conditions and subsidies for people who can't afford the premiums for health care. It is a massive piece of legislation. And it could disrupt the markets and bring health care delivery in this country to a very rickety stage. I'm not saying it would shut down or anything like that, but it could create the kind of uncertainty that would cause certain companies to stop offering insurance or other things that are kind of hard to predict at this point. California's Attorney General Javier Becerra, quote, "The district court's ruling poses a dangerous threat to the health care of millions of Americans. Today's filing makes clear that California and its other states will do everything possible to challenge this reckless ruling." For its part, the administration says they will continue enforcing all aspects of the ACA as it had before the court issued its decision. They've been actively undermining the ACA every way they can, and I imagine that's what they will continue to do. So we'll see how all this plays out, but it does put a lot of pressure on Congress and, of course, the replacement that Trump promised everybody, right? Yeah, he was going to repeal and replace Obamacare. There's never been a finger lifted to replace it, and it'll be really interesting to see if they just want to let it die and let Americans die along the way. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, Wendy Gebauer, Joey Perillo in Philly, and Faith Peoples. They all kick in $5 or $10 a month, and I would appreciate it if you consider becoming a subscriber, because it's what makes this whole system work, covers the bills, and encourages me to show up every day. So visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and it's easy to choose a PayPal subscription that fits your budget. The $50 annual earns you the bonus gift. That is a CD by John Dist. The new one is called American University. And should you like to communicate with me, use the U.S. mail. My address is Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And I like to hear from you with or without a subscription. Yesterday, James Comey came out of a hearing where, once again, Republicans quizzed him on the Hillary email investigation and all that stuff. And I'm not going to get into those details. We've covered it before. I don't believe that Comey did the right thing regarding the email investigation, but I don't think that anything is ever going to change that. At any rate, he gave a lecture to people of his own political party. St. James Comey is a Republican. And he said, "Republicans have to have the courage to stand up and speak the truth, not be cowed by mean tweets or fear of their base." And his full comments were pretty nasty and critical of Trump. And, well, other than the fact that I don't think the FBI is pure as the driven snow, I do understand what drove Comey's comments. Quote, "This, while the President of the United States is lying about the FBI, attacking the FBI, attacking the rule of law in this country, how does that make sense at all?" And he also noted that Trump called Michael Cohen a rat, which is mobster language. And I think he correctly noted that that's beneath the dignity of what we expect or expected from a president of the United States. "I have tales of two domestic terrorism cases and FBI surveillance. We start with one, Oakland and Berkeley, California. A 23-year-old Berkeley High graduate named Amr Sinan Al-Haga. Al-Hagi. There are quite a few G's in there. Al-Hagagi. Yeah, that's what it is. Al-Hagagi. He pleaded guilty last July to attempting to provide material support to a terrorist group. So now he is at the sentencing stage, and suddenly the FBI releases surveillance tapes. Hidden camera operations, the undercover agent who was assigned to Al-Hagagi. And I want you to listen carefully as I quote from the FBI transcripts of these surveillance reports. and you will hear, Mr. Al-Haggagi. Always use the plural. When he talks about these fanciful schemes that he wants to carry out, he talked to his FBI agent about a plot to bomb nightclubs in San Francisco. And you know, they're all crowded, so it doesn't matter which one we hit. Later, the video showed Al-Haggagi as he's in the passenger seat of a car, blurred out FBI agents driving him around the East Bay. And he talks about ordering strychnine on a Chinese website. And asked what he's going to do with it, he told the agent, well, we were thinking about either selling it as drugs or mixing it in drugs. Then he talked about torching the hills of Oakland and Berkeley with gasoline. And we can just drive and do it real quick and drive away smoothly. And finally, when asked about blowing up a building at the UC Berkeley campus, oh, I've been so excited about it. I've been hyped up. Like, how I'm seeing it, we could get away so easily. Now, the reason I bring this up, oh, there's even one more. He talks about there's so many homeless people here that would do it for you, like for a dollar or something. Like I could tell them to walk into the YMCA with a bag and they'll do it and we could detonate it from outside. All of these talk about we. In the history of FBI undercover agents working with these so-called domestic terrorism suspects is that the FBI guy comes up with the plot, comes up with the explosives or whatever other, you know, material is needed. And the schlub believes that they're part of a team. And in the end, the schlub is left standing alone as his teammate is exposed as an FBI paid informant. Now to the case in New York City. This is the situation of the Uzbek man, Saifulo Saipov, age 30. He's charged with using a truck to kill 8 people on that Manhattan bike path last year. Now, this is different from the Oakland-Berkeley case, because from everything I can tell, the Saipov case is not driven by an FBI informant. But lawyers said in court papers they had received a trove of materials from the government concerning surreptitious FBI surveillance of Saipov's communications, including numerous audio recordings of conversations between Saipov and various targets of FBI surveillance. So this is suggesting that they hadn't targeted Saipov personally, but he showed up in their surveillance of other individuals. And they put a wiretap on his phone the night before he began the attack. So my point here is not to try to infer that there was inappropriate behavior in the Saipov case, but that we spend so much time trying to frame up these schlubs, like this boastful kid from Berkeley, that it diverts resources from cases of people who are likely to commit a terrorist act. And this misplacement of our resources and the legal efforts that go along with it is at the basis of my criticism of the FBI since 9/11. Now, in the case of Saipov, Trump has tweeted that he should get the death penalty. And this is the kind of presidential interference that was unheard of before Trump took office. Republican, Democrat, they have all shown great restraint and avoided interfering in active cases. And Trump doesn't even have the self-control to wait more than 10 minutes until, you know, after a Fox and Friends viewing, he gets on Twitter and has intervened in an extraordinary manner in a case of a guy, Major Matthew Goldstein, who is accused of a summary execution of a Taliban suspect in Afghanistan. And this guy, Goldstein, has not once but twice gone public bragging about what he did. He volunteered the information during a job interview with the CIA in 2011. The Army opened an investigation at that time but didn't charge Major Goldstein. 5 years later, appearing where? Fox News. Major Goldstein confides in Sean Hannity. Yeah, I killed that guy. And this has led to the new investigation that has led to the murder charges that were placed against Goldstein last week. Now, I wasn't there. I don't prejudge this situation. But Trump saw a 2 or 3 minute report on Fox News, and that's all he needs. It's the same way he inappropriately intervened in the Bo Bergdahl desertion case, calling him a dirty, rotten traitor. It is appalling. We live in an appalling era. And over the weekend, Americans yawned, if they even know about this by now. But Trump authorized 6 U.S. airstrikes in Somalia. 4 on Saturday that killed 34 people, 2 on Sunday killed 28. We are protecting Somalia from al-Shabaab. And I just have a few questions. What is the basis for authorizing U.S. military action in Somalia? Because Obama did it? Is that all Trump needs? Where's Congress? Where's the War Powers Act? What treaty requires us to defend Somalia from al-Shabaab? How many other little skirmishes do we have going on in Africa? We know about the one in Niger, where American soldiers died. And so it goes. The Saudis didn't apparently understand the dance that the U.S. Senate put in motion last week when they passed the resolution saying that Trump should get out of Yemen, stop supporting that war, and then unanimously passed a second resolution saying that it is the belief of the Senate that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd. The reason they didn't get the hint about how the dance is conducted is that they lashed out on Monday at the United States Senate. Apparently, MBS didn't understand that this is a ritual where the U.S. government displays outrage as a substitute for any major action in response to the murder of Khashoggi, the brutal war in Yemen, where millions of people are on the verge of starvation. And by the way, the ceasefire is underway in Hodeidah, at least in the early stages. And so the Saudi Foreign Ministry criticized the resolution, saying it was based on unsubstantiated claims and allegations and contained blatant interference in the kingdom's internal affairs, undermining the kingdom's regional and international role. And the kingdom rejects any interference in its internal affairs and accusations that disrespect its leadership. Come on. MBS, when you get a toothless slap on the wrist, just take it. Meanwhile, Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, is looking for a way to end their multi-billion dollar deal to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. Trudeau told the Question Period TV show on Sunday, "We are engaged with the export permits to try and see if there's a way of no longer exporting these vehicles to Saudi Arabia." Germany and Sweden have canceled arms contracts, but not the good old U.S. of A. No, we're not going to let go of that. Little good news for the mother of a 2-year-old American boy who is near death at Children's Hospital in Oakland. The father's an American citizen who married a woman from Yemen. She has been trapped in Egypt trying to get a visa to the United States to visit her dying son, and the Trump administration relented and issued her a permit to travel yesterday. But they're still creating havoc in the Cambodian and Vietnamese-American communities. We have more than 100,000 people of Vietnamese ancestry in San Jose and Orange County, including the city of Santa Ana in the southern part of the state, have a huge population of Vietnamese immigrants as well. And what's happening is that Trump is reneging on agreements that were made in the past to protect Vietnamese immigrants who came to the U.S. before 1995. Now, there have been a wave of them, a handful of people already deported, and this makes everybody in the Vietnamese-American communities extremely nervous. And over at Shadowproof, There is a good backgrounder written by Michael Senato about the way in which Trump is determined to violate these agreements and try to deport these people who, by all accounts, have a low crime rate as a group and who have made significant contributions to the American communities that they've moved to. You may have seen the reports about baby powder, Johnson's baby powder, talcum powder. And this summer, 22 women with ovarian cancer successfully sued the company, arguing that they knew about the connection between talc and asbestos. And a jury in St. Louis awarded $4.69 billion, one of the largest personal injury verdicts ever. So today in my San Francisco Chronicle, the big lie and a full-page ad, science, not sensationalism. Johnson & Johnson has been in the news lately about the talc in our baby powder. We know how important this is to you, so we'd like to tell you the facts. Our talc is safe. Good luck with that one, J&J. And at Who, What, Why, Doug Vaughn produces the Kavanaugh angle. Now, when Brett Kavanaugh was going through the process of confirmation to the Supreme Court, we heard a lot about his mom, who'd been a local judge in the D.C. area, but we didn't hear a lot of details about his dad. And Ed Kavanaugh was a longtime lobbyist, and one of his clients is Johnson & Johnson through the Cosmetic Fragrance and Toiletries Association, which is now called the Personal Care Products Council, PCPC. And so it makes sense that if the J&J talcum powder asbestos case makes it to the Supreme Court, that Brett Kavanaugh would have to recuse himself. But would he? Time will tell. And meanwhile, if you take a powder, don't make it Johnson & Johnson. Yair Netanyahu, 27-year-old son of the Prime Minister of Israel, was banned from Facebook for 24 hours. I guess that's special treatment because of who he is. He had posted what many people consider to be hate speech after he called for revenge against, quote, those monsters following the fatal shooting of two Israeli soldiers by a Palestinian last week. And Netanyahu put up a screenshot of one of the posts that was removed by Facebook and wrote, "The thought police of the radical progressives at Facebook have reached me as well." Facebook responded, "Yair Netanyahu posted several posts which include hate speech. This clearly violates our community standards. Due to that, this content was removed from our platform, as we would do for anyone posting similar content about any protected characteristic." Following this, Yair Netanyahu decided to share a screenshot of a removed post and called people to share it, which is the same as writing the hate speech all over again. And it's not his first offense. Meanwhile, a group of activists and organizations are calling for Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg to step down from the board of directors at Facebook. And this is pissing in the wind, I just have to say. Zuckerberg owns 60% of the voting shares of Facebook, and he will ignore any of these demands. They're calling on new management. They say it's become abundantly clear that your leadership team is unable to adequately address the valid concerns of the civil rights community. It is now time for significant changes in not only your policies, but also your leadership structure. And I want to invite you to read a piece by my friend Norman Solomon. It's over at Common Dreams today. The link is in the show file for today's podcast. He tells the truth about Beto O'Rourke, and he's not out to condemn him or to marginalize his potential impact on the 2020 presidential race. It's just that Beto O'Rourke became a rock star mainly because he took on Ted Cruz and he gave a speech that went viral on the internet, where he gave a great answer to a question about NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem. But when you look at the record that one of the top recipients of oil and gas campaign contributions is Beto O'Rourke, the pushback from Neera Tanden at the Center for American Progress, and the mixed record of Beto O'Rourke in his three terms in the Congress, It's worth knowing who he really is. And I hear Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii is ready to announce for the presidency. There's a lot I like about Tulsi, and I have some reservations, so it'll be interesting to see if she does take the plunge. And my junior senator from California, Kamala Harris, is expected to announce her candidacy formally after the holiday break. And as usual, I will mention that I think it's too early for her to make that move. Finally today, I have linked to the great piece that Andy Worthington wrote about Judge John J. Gibbons, who passed away last weekend at the age of 94. Despite being appointed to the Court of Appeals by Richard Nixon, a staunch conservative Republican, after he retired, he volunteered to represent prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He was central to the Raul versus Bush lawsuit that caused the Supreme Court to declare that Guantanamo prisoners have habeas corpus rights. And he also participated in Boumediene versus Bush in June 2008. There's more to his story. I encourage you to read the nice memorial piece that Andy Worthington wrote about the judge. The link is in the show file for today's podcast. It's all at peterbcollins.com. You got that? Thanks for listening. Send me your comments. And remember, you can find this podcast on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.